Welcome to Two-Way Street. This week's show reminds me that there are far too many moments in my life when I look but don't see. I've driven past walls covered with graffiti, noticed it on the sides of bridges and on highway underpasses, but I've never stopped to see it, let alone thought much about who put it there or why. I had no idea that there's an entire subculture of people immersed in the world of graffiti writing. A number of years ago, graffiti emerged from where it had been hiding in plain sight and was embraced by many in the mainstream fine arts world. The best graffiti writers took their place beside street artists like Banksy and Jean-Michel Basquiat, who also had started out painting their work on public spaces but had become darlings of the fine art scene. Today, we're going to talk to one of the best-known graffiti writers to emerge from Atlanta's underground scene, Dax Rudnack, a.k.a. Dr. Dax. Dax has had a colorful and not always on the up-and-up life. He was attracted to the graffiti he saw around him from the time he was a young boy growing up in Atlanta, and he started doing his own early on. After he graduated from Grady High School, Dax fell in with a crowd of young black kids who were trying to make it as rappers and hip-hop artists. When Andre 3000, Big Boy, Goody Mob, and others soared to the top of the music world, they took their white friend Dax along for the ride. He directed some of their music videos, and he partied hard right along with them. Dax became a drug dealer and says he made a lot of money in the trade, but he finally got out of the business because what he really wanted to do was to make his mark in spray paint. While he started as a star of the underground graffiti world, he's emerged as an artist whose graffiti canvases can now be seen in art galleries that feature cutting-edge work. A little later in the show, we'll talk to High Museum curator Michael Rooks about an exhibition now at the High that features the work of street artist Basquiat. But first, Dr. Dax. If you were to encounter Dax on a lonely street in the dead of night, your impulse might be to run. He's an intimidating-looking man. He's covered in tattoos from the top of his shaved head to his feet, and his body appears compact and strong. But on the day he came to the Two-Way Street studio, he was wearing a sweatshirt that covered his tattoos and a hat that hid his shaved head. Dax has a history of lacing his speech with profanity. I mean, like every other word. But he kept it clean in our conversation. He seems to me to like cultivating the image of a gangsta. But as we talked, I thought he was a very sweet and clearly talented guy. Dax Rudnack.
Yes.
Welcome to Two-Way Street.
Thanks for having me.
Would you prefer your professional title of Dr. Dax?
I can call me anything. Nothing really bothers me as long as I respond.
What are you a doctor of exactly?
I've always been pretty good with helping people with little cuts and scratches and stuff, but I'd say mainly I've been considered a doctor for my extraordinary studies of graffiti and graffiti history. It's not something, especially back in the time when I started, that you could just read up on the internet. You had to really get out there and find some people who were deeply rooted in the underground and get to digging, you know?
Where'd you live when you were a boy growing up in Atlanta?
I grew up all over Midtown, you know, anywhere between, 14th and 10th Street where we are now, and Little Five Points and East Atlanta. I moved a lot, even as an adult.
Why were you moving?
My father was an artist as well, so his money was up and down, as artists are. So sometimes, he'd have a small apartment, maybe even a studio apartment, and sometimes he'd be renting a four-bedroom house, just depending on kind of money he was making. But
what kind of art did your dad do?
My dad was a commercial artist, and he did a lot of magazine covers from anything from, probably whatever the Atlanta magazine was, to Newsweek, even Penthouse. So he did a lot of commercial art, super commercial art.
So he's primarily an illustrator.
That's right.
When did you decide you wanted to start being an artist? What kind of art? Did you doodle a lot? Did you paint? What was your first experience?
Yeah, even on my own as a child, before I lived with my father, I lived with my mother in Florida, and I was always doodling. I was trying to draw cars and stuff like that. So when I moved to Atlanta, I seen that my dad was really immersed in the painting. But what caught my interest the most was riding MARTA and seeing the graffiti out the window. It was very mysterious and very mischievous and as a kid, it was almost like, to me, my first spark of seeing like maybe a comic book hero or something. These people seemed to me like superhero types. They're very mysterious, didn't know who they were, didn't know how to figure out who they were and how they did what they did or even got to where they got.
Like, was really it excited. On the sides of buildings?
Yeah, I was on the rooftops and sides of buildings, looking out the window of the MARTA train, you know, going from stop to stop. And then I would switch around just to go back and look at everything and then have to go back the other way to look at the other side of the train windows. And there was a good bit of it here at that time. So ever since then, I've been really excited about public art.
I've read that a book that made a real impact on you was Subway Art. You found a copy of Subway Art by Martha Cooper and Henry Chalfant, right?
That's correct.
Two photographers.
That's my Bible.
They were two photographers in New York who began separately documenting graffiti, mostly on the subway trains of New York. And we all, this book was published, I think, in like 1986. And we all remember, I think, back in those days, New York subways were just covered with graffiti, right?
That's correct.
Why did that book matter to you so much?
Well, when I moved to Atlanta, the graffiti here was still very in its early stages, which I would compare to New York's probably late 60s or, you know, the very beginning of the 70s. And that's pretty much where we were with graffiti. When I saw the book Subway Art, I'd seen something way more advanced and way more futuristic. Seemed like many generations have passed, lots of traditions and things have been set in stone. So I figured that out immediately reading that book. That's why I call it a Bible. It was definitely like some sort of handbook to life and the lifestyle of graffiti. You know, even the lingo, that book really broke it down. And then seeing it on moving objects changed the things. Like, being in Atlanta, seeing graffiti from a moving object to seeing it on moving objects in the book blew my mind.
Yeah.
And so that even took it way further. I became obsessed since then. I wasn't even able to learn in school because I was always drawing graffiti.
Did you know that Cooper and Chalfant had a hard time finding an American publisher for the book?
I didn't know that, but I could believe that at the time.
Do you know why they couldn't get a publisher? Because graffiti was so stigmatized,
right?
Because it was considered a blight on the landscape, that no publisher here wanted to touch that.
That's very easy to believe. Even in my experience of taking photographs of graffiti and making magazines, we couldn't ever get people to, they would show interest in our magazine until they really found out that it was vandalism and graffiti. That was in the 90s and even to the 2000s, we couldn't get advertising, which I don't think there's any problem getting advertising now. I work for many corporate entities, you know, so.
It's come a long way. It's funny you use the word vandalism because Cooper told an interviewer at one point, she said that she found it hard to understand how the graffiti artists who were writing on subway trains divorced themselves from the art. They didn't want to acknowledge that it was art and that it was good. They considered it an act of vandalism.
Yeah, and just writing. It was just plain writing. I wasn't like a painter, an illustrator, or a writer, just a writer. It was just lettering, you know? And no matter how creative and how advanced the lettering got, no matter how many 3Ds and shines you put on it, shadows, whatever, it still was just writing.
When you started, had you done graffiti before that book? In other words, after riding MARTA and seeing buildings, had you already started doing some graffiti of your own here?
Well, I started when I came to Atlanta. I created a tag at the time, which I just wrote TR. And when I moved to Atlanta, I just immediately off the airplane just came and started writing with my little Sharpies and started finding spray paint, stealing spray paint from my father. I just started writing it everywhere.
What did TR stand for?
At the time, it stood for totally ridiculous. And, you know, I went into had many, many names after that.
What's the impulse behind that? You would find buildings all over town, wherever you were.
Yes.
And you would put TR. You'd spray paint it on the side of the building.
Yes.
What's the impulse?
It's pretty hard to explain, but I think overall as a child, I mean, I guess maybe even just the fact that you know other people will see it, there's something in that. I think it goes back in time. People have always wanted to leave their mark of some sort or leave some sort of communication. And that even goes along with, you know, just to write TR and maybe write some sort of a clever quote next to it, you know, like you just even was here. TR was here. And after a while, you know, when I would write it in front of my friends, they'd be like, oh, that's you. And it just kind of starts building from there. It becomes some sort of a drug, you know, a high. And then, you know, moving on to moving objects, it just goes way out of control. Like a friend of mine by the name of SB1 used to tell me to write on walls is natural, but to write on trains is divine. And that always stuck with me, and I think that's true.
It's interesting because do you know who Kilroy was?
I didn't know him personally, but I think he was like a World War II, came out of some sort of political statements or something.
Kilroy was here.
Kilroy
became
was here.
A ubiquitous little drawing.
Little guy with the big nose.
With a big nose that popped up all over Europe in the European theater during World War II. I suppose, I never thought of it before, Kilroy is kind of the first graffiti artist.
Well, they say that, yeah. They say, like, as far, there's different levels to that, because they say, like, the first guy who really started tagging his name on freight trains was J.B. King Esquire. He was tagging trains at the, you know, doing monikers with oil bars on the freight trains in the turn of the century, and he has a beautiful one-line J.B. King Esquire that's circled. It's a very fancy signature, which most people said he must have went to a pretty damn good school, and that his father possibly even owned some of the train lines. And that's why his signature was so beautiful. You can look up pictures of it. But he definitely struck up, you know, what would become, you know, hobo monikers and folk art on freight trains from the 1900s all the way till now. Something that really stuck around. A lot of train workers, a lot of people started doing. So a lot of people even thought subway art in New York was probably the first of its kind, but it wasn't. The freight train monikers were the first as far as moving objects go. But then you can trace writing on walls back all the way to the pyramids and, you know, pharaohs and all that stuff. So
yeah.
I think it's just always been human nature to
put your mark,
but make it the more noticeable it can be, the better of a place it is.
We're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we'll have more with my guest, Dr. Dax Rudnack. Welcome back to Two Way Street. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Dax Rudnack, known in graffiti circles as Dr. Dax. He started writing graffiti all over Atlanta when he was just a teenager. He graduated to putting his designs on the cars of freight trains. Now, he spray paints graffiti on canvases and has become a crossover artist who is sought after by fine art galleries and collectors. How did it make you feel as you watched the city of New York go to war against the graffiti artists who the establishment in New York felt were, you know, were defacing public property, that sort of thing?
Man, I mean, it's like Style Wars is a documentary that was made by Henry Chalfant, which was part of Subway Art, but they interview Koch, which was the mayor at the time.
Yep.
Yeah, they were interviewing him. They were showing him some of my favorite writers and whole car pieces that were in the book. They were showing him, I think, some of the pages from Subway Art. And they're like, you know, like, how can you say that's vandalism? He's like, oh, those are exceptional. If the problem is the millions of people who try to replicate that. And that probably stands true in any city for anybody. You know, I probably, for everything good I do and pieces that I've spent my whole life developing and people they love, there's probably about 100 kids that try to mimic what I do and don't really understand it all the way. So some of the mess, you know, probably is spawned off of what we do. I think it's the same thing with how New York was. People started wanting to be Dondi and, you know, Is the Wiz and Zephyrs and all those guys, and started seeing that stuff rolling by, and we're like, I'm going to take a lick at it too. You know, everybody was taking a lick at it. And I think it became such a part of New York culture. I mean, you go to New York and every single person, even if they're a real serious about it or not, they have a tag name probably or whatever. It's just every kid in New York, even young girls all the way through the late 70s, 80s, 90s till now, have a hand style, have a name, a graffiti name, whether
let's reel off
they pursue
some of
it or not.
Let's reel off some of those names. They're great names.
All right.
Just
from the 70s, my favorite.
Well, from any period.
Yeah, like Super Cool 223, Stay High 149, Cool Disco Dan from D.C. Guys from here were like Sir Leon and Sir Smith. Those are the types of names going on in Atlanta.
Obviously, people talk about painting graffiti sometimes. But more frequently, we talk about writing.
Writing, yes.
Which is interesting to me because writing is different from art, doing something artistic in
That's
my
right.
mind. It's a different word entirely.
And writers, too. They look at a lot of stuff that people do that you might see not even as the writing culture. They call it spray can art or street art and, you know, there's a million labels that come along now, but writers definitely like to always be considered a writer,
right,
not a vandal necessarily. Even the word graffiti, a lot of writers don't even like to be called graffiti writers because they say that graffiti's unwanted markings. And a lot of people like to think of their stuff as being wanted, whether with permission or not.
Okay, but I'm asking you a different question. Given the choice between calling yourself an artist and a writer, most of the people who do graffiti prefer to be called writers.
That's
why?
Right. I think maybe a lot of people like to be considered writers too because we didn't look at it as like an art form that we learned these techniques and all this stuff. It was just pretty much straightforward writing your name.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So one of the things you're known for here in Atlanta is you looked at the subway art that you saw in New York and you decided that you ought to transfer that to freight trains.
That's right.
How did that happen?
Well, living in Atlanta, which was the main hub of freight trains and connecting all the North American train lines to the South, this is like a, you know, even till this day, but all the industries that have shut down and all the lines that have been shut down, there's still huge train yards here. A lot of trains still come here to be separated and sent off into their final destinations or whatever, or the other way around. And growing up here, and it seemed this, I mean, the second I saw subway art, I was like, oh man, there's trains right in my backyard. You know, there's trains everywhere. Everywhere I hang out, there's always trains. So I instantly went and started painting on them. And maybe that was a direct result of reading subway art, but I'd already like caught maybe a couple tags on them. And then when I saw that book, I really just went crazy on that too. And that led into meeting some of the greatest people I've ever known.
All right, you decided to start writing on freight trains.
That's right.
Were you writing on moving freight trains? How do you go about it? What is the stealth activity that's involved in being able to do what is essentially illegal vandalism?
Yeah, well, you know, there's definitely different levels of ways to get away with that. I won't go too deep into it just for the kids who still, you know, keep that a secret. But just for the – I never write on moving ones. I used to always stay away from moving trains. I don't care how dumb you are. When you get near those things, they're so huge and powerful and like monsters rolling by. They're loud. You know they're not nothing to mess with. At least I did always. So I always used to just try to find a nice one that doesn't seem like it's going to move anytime soon, which I learned the hard way too, that, you know, start painting something and start working on it, making something nice, and the thing pulls off. But there's definitely ways of finding ones that aren't going to move, and you just got to do your research and studying and figure it out.
Is this stuff that happens in the middle of the night? Is it having to go into a train yard somewhere where
trains train yards parked? Sometimes are the worst places to go because they're so busy, you know, and that's where they're active. Trying to find a non-active one in a hidden spot. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the middle of the night. When I was younger, I used to be pretty dumb. I used to actually go around 6 a.m. just because I wasn't allowed to stay out all night all the time. But my dad would let me get up as early as I wanted to venture out. I was always liked getting up the crack of dawn just to try to make the most of all my summer days, especially. You know, I knew a couple places where trains just sat there, sitting there, and I think they were empties. So I even figured out that time, like, that nobody probably really cared about them. And I was seeing the monikers, which were done by people who were not graffiti writers.
Monikers are?
Monikers being done with, they're always done with oil bars, which I think maybe was like some sort of.
What does that mean, an oil bar?
An oil bar, it's not a thing for art, but they do sell things like that in art. I think they would be called
They're like crayon. They're crayon, yeah, but with an oil base.
Kind of like what they write on your
color.
Windshield with when you get your car towed. I think it's something that the rail system started providing for their workers.
And you would put, and you said that you use an oil bar to put your moniker.
Moniker. And a moniker would be, what's his name? Like the Colossus of Rhodes, the Rambler of Beaumont, Texas, you know, or some Bozo, Texas, you know, a bunch of like very, very Americana.
What's your moniker?
I didn't have a moniker. I was a graffiti writer, so there's a difference, you know?
Okay,
the
I
monikers,
don't understand. Now, you the, okay, now I'm yeah, lost.
Yeah,
what's
the monikers
difference?
Would be like J.B. King Esquire, the guy in the 1900s. You know, those guys who started writing their names and dating them. They'd write them with a date. Then they started incorporating some sort of imagery.
Okay.
You know, like the solo artist draws the mountains with the guy with the glasses looking into the mountains, the little river stream, and the train tracks wrapping around.
Okay.
So monikers are, you know, a lot of hobos did them. There's always a hobos or rail workers. Anybody who's in like immersed in the railroad, we call the railroad earth.
You said once, train spotting is where I go to get in touch with nature. Watching trains is a place where I find zen.
That's true, yes. I would compare it to maybe how some men go fishing. You know, it's not even about catching a fish. I guess it's just about the journey of being out there in the wilderness and having the patience to maybe wait on a good one and maybe sometimes catch just a bunch of little ones, you know, and waiting on trains the same way. You know, usually we're waiting around to see possibly our own stuff, also the writings and monikers of others. So, you know, you can wait around all day and see a bunch of good stuff.
Where do you go in this
anywhere
city?
Anywhere you can see trains rolling by is a good place, but I always I like visiting all the yards. You know, you can go to anywhere from Hapeville, Union City, Forest Park to Tilford Yard, Inman Yard. I usually just roll by yards. Ever since 9/11, it's been a little more strict. Homeland Security is no joke, you know. But if you can make yourself familiar enough, they know who you are. They won't even stop after a while. And there's plenty of people, rail fanners. There's guys who don't do anything but just take pictures of the engines. But you, after all the years of watching trains, I've run into every type of guy. But there's people in Georgia who've been doing this stuff 30, 40 years.
Whether they're painting graffiti or not.
They're not even painting graffiti. They sit out there with their walkie-talkies and their monitors and stuff. They tell me what engines are coming. You know, they're called rail fanners.
Yeah, yeah.
Guys look a little bit like yourself.
Old.
Old guys, yeah. But they're interesting. They always have a grip of knowledge, you know. So, and the older I get, you know, the more so I don't even necessarily care about the graffiti stuff. So I love running into these guys and hearing what they got to say and seeing the old engines, and they know all the model numbers and the history behind some of these things. Sometimes they know that they've been repainted and redone, and they want to see it come through and take a epic picture of it.
So what were you, when you first started writing on freight trains here?
Yes.
What were you writing?
Name-wise?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I started writing, I think the first ones I was doing like busy pieces. I was writing Dax, D-A-K-S. I also wrote Rifsky. I wrote Prone, Macer, T-R. I could probably go on and on. I had a lot of names back then. I didn't really, being as young as I wasn't catching on to a lot of the things that I know now.
Were you everything done in spray paint?
No, not at first. Oh, well, you know, even till this day, I've been pretty open to using anything. I'll scratch, you know, my name with a rock into something when I was younger. But, you know, as I got older, started getting nicer markers, started making my own markers, finding out what inks were, you know, flowed better, were a little more permanent. Spray paint's always been awesome, you know, especially Rust-Oleum was always our favorite.
So you go out, let's say, you identify a place where you know you're going to find a car from a train.
Yes.
Are there certain kinds of cars that are better for writing on than others?
These days, yeah, people have been very picky. People want to go for the flat ones and the box cars, you know, certain ones, you know, like the refrigerator cars are very flat and big and usually white. And almost every person who started writing, especially as far as recently, they go after those cars with a vengeance. And now they're starting to go over each other and fight over them. They look like subways from New York now when you see them roll by, which I used to not see anything written on cars except for maybe some monikers, or you get lucky to see some cool graffiti. And these days, every single one of those cars, but we've, me and some of my friends always kind of liked all of them. We thought all of them were a go. And, you know, we weren't scared of any ridges or one being too rusty or too round or whatever, you know, whatever the complaints these guys
have.
So
what supplies are you taking with you when you go to the
train? Usually when I do that, I'll only bring spray paint and preferably Rust-Oleum enamel. It lasts forever.
I want to read you something that was written about your work.
All right.
A critic, an art critic. And we're going to talk about this transition that you made to become
a good criticism.
An artist. But yeah, well, we all love critics,
yeah,
don't we,
yeah,
Dax?
Yeah.
Dr. Dax, pop-infused, overinflated, candy-colored letters convey remarkable energy and ebullient goodwill. Dr. Dax also has a tendency to animate and infuse his text with personality, capping his letters with a layer of white frosting or giving each letter its own textural signature, making his words and letters lively and fun. Now, that's a good review.
I like that. Where'd you read that at?
I read that in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
Good Lord, I like that.
Art critic
Felicia
Feaster wrote that about your work.
I need to memorize that for when people ask me about my work.
So, but here's the point. She clearly thinks your work is fun. Is that what you want it to be?
Definitely. I when I was younger, you know, I grew up, and not necessarily because I was into punk rock and, like, you know, skinhead culture and that, but just even on everybody I went to school with at the time, I don't know what it was, but something about the turn up from the 80s to the 90s, everybody was really into violence. You know, the answer for everything was just to fight it out, one-on-one fights. People started getting into guns. And we kind of thought that was what, you know, as kids, we thought that's just life, what it was. I don't know what it was, but we had just a lot of violence back in Atlanta back in those days. Everybody was fighting about everything. And I started kind of getting bummed out about it, you know, when everybody else was kind of getting off on it. And then also Atlanta's always been very brick and very dim. I just knew the brighter the colors I used, the more you just stuck out
on. What are your favorite colors?
I love all the pastel colors. I love putting pastel colors, Easter egg type stuff, and I love outlining it in black.
Yeah.
That's my favorite part of doing what I do is just putting that black outline. And I don't always do that, but that's been pretty much my color theory. But, you know, growing up in Florida and going to Miami, to South Beach, even when it was abandoned as a kid for hurricane season, I always used to just get lit up on all the colors on the Art Deco hotels. And then even when I moved to Atlanta, we used to go in the candy aisle at the Kroger at the grocery store and just I'd get light up, you know, lit up and see all the bubble gum and all the candy wrappers. And I think just being a child, that just instantly was like, I'm going to try to make that my look.
What is the Dungeon family?
The Dungeon family was a bunch of guys from the SWATs, which is Southwest Atlanta, East Point to College Park area. They'd all came together, a bunch of creative, all young black men who came together because they were all had the same vision of doing great music. And then in that, you know, it branched out into being different divisions of that even, but it ended up being Outkast. Yeah, it's from National Underground, Thunderbounds, when I stop the ground. And Goody Mob. And Cool Breeze. Witch Doctor, Big Rube, you know, other people who are in the music industry, some people who aren't in the music industry, but definitely just a big group of guys who.
And you got to know these guys before they became.
Yeah.
Big stars.
I mean, you know, all of us were young, so nobody was any more important or creative than anyone else. And then as time went on, you know, some guys definitely hit the jackpot, which being Outkast would probably be the number one guys. The world really took to them, and that really blew everybody's mind because not a lot of hip-hop artists were emerging out of Atlanta. There was some guys, local heroes like Kilo and Raheem the Dream, and people loved that here. And I thought that was just the music was being played everywhere, but I go visit my mom in Florida, people didn't have a clue what that was, you know.
How old were you at this point? So what year are we talking about?
We're talking years. About 1987, 88, 89.
All right, so you were still young.
Very young,
and they
yeah.
were too.
Well, yeah, and I met them at a time when, you know, Atlanta at least started having its own sound and music. We were listening to people, and we might have thought that was the whole world, but the radio was pretty much just being biased, I guess, or being cool and letting that local stuff, you know, letting it ride. And then Outkast and all that emerged out of that. Ichiban Records and So Def and all this, you know, like a lot of bass music, which was a Miami sound. And I guess people, mainly being Organized Noise and Outkast, wanted to start having, you know, creating the Atlanta sound.
Yeah, you said in an interview once, people who made music here had it in their minds they would never blow up. They're like, you can't be an Atlanta artist and blow up. But it was Dallas Austin who came along and changed all that. Who was Dallas Austin?
Dallas Austin is the guy who started TLC. He had Rowdy Records. He moved on to produce for Michael Jackson, Madonna, Stevie Nicks. I mean, you name it. Lenny Kravitz, probably one of the biggest super producers ever out of Atlanta.
Right.
You know, somebody, I guess, who in the past would be kind of like Quincy Jones or something.
So, Dex, here you are going to Grady High School.
Yes.
And, I mean, you're a white guy. And I'm assuming, like most environments, white kids stuck with white kids, black kids with black kids,
yeah.
Unfortunate as it might be. And here you are hanging around with all these young black guys who are going to be hip-hop artists. How did that happen?
I think maybe coming from Florida, I didn't really, I didn't fall into place with anybody. So when I came here, I either didn't fall into place with anybody or I fell into place with everybody, you know. I kind of just went back and forth with people just not having it with me. And then some people just loved me to death. It's right when I got here, being black and white. So I guess being different, I got to like fall in with the right people. God just put me right in a place. And then meeting the Dungeon family was just great for me because a lot of people I went to school with, everybody wanted to play sports. My older brother played sports. My dad wanted me to play sports. It was very about being into sports here, and I was very not into that.
Yeah.
So meeting those guys, they didn't necessarily – they liked to watch sports, but they weren't into playing sports as much. They were trying to be creative, and, you know, some of them were also graffiti writers, Organized Noise, Ray Murray, Sleepy Brown, and Rico Wade. Those guys were into graffiti. Ray Murray was one of the first graffiti writers in Atlanta. So when I met those guys, that was naturally just like, oh, wow, you were the first. And they didn't even care about that stuff anymore. They were so into music,
they
trying to make music.
Music.
But, you know, just a little bit of knowledge I can get, just like being an archaeologist, I was just digging, like, when did you do that? Who'd you do that with? Who was this guy? Just trying to figure out what I could figure out. So that kind of struck up a relationship between me and some of those guys, too.
They took you on the ride with them as
That's
they
right.
became famous. You want to put on your headphones for a minute?
Sure.
So Jenny's going to play you a little something.
All right. Got up stuck like Chuck in the well. We weave like a lace front rig stuck to the forehead. Best believe I'll change the steeds. Take the lead, change the speed. Slow it down just for the sport. Nigga, one of my favorite rappers happens to be too short. Everybody want to sell dope. That's right.
Who is that?
That's a Big Boy solo album. Big Boy from Outkast. He did a song with Too Short, which is a legendary Oakland hip-hop artist and pioneer. And, of course, the father of funk.
George Clinton's in there,
that's
too.
That's right. Yeah, and that was interesting because we got to hang out with those guys.
So that's the soundtrack, that's the audio portion of one of the videos.
Yeah, the video that produced. I directed, one of many videos I directed. That one I did with Zach Wolf, which is a photographer from here. And we got to go with Big Boy to Savannah, and I believe we did 3 or 4 videos all in one go, which I don't know if anybody's ever quite did anything like that, but... Since I was taking a nice lick at directing videos at the time, which I'm into doing anything visual, Big Boy asked me to go to Savannah and just start knocking out videos. And so we got a humongous budget and went down there and partied for a couple weeks and flew people like Too Short and George Clinton out. Got to just, I don't know, that was a really good experience at the time.
Especially because
I wasn't a seasoned director at the time. It was just, I've always taken photographs, always documented, and not necessarily with a focus. But I think just having a natural talent for visual, I just instantly folded right into that. Fine. And Big Boy believed in me, and I'm glad he did. Appreciate you, Big Boy.
So let's talk a little bit about transitions in your life. We talked about the fact that the initial graffiti writers absolutely rejected the idea of being considered artists, and you did too.
Yes. At first. Yeah, maybe that's, in the modern world of things, how they are, that's just maybe a natural progression, too, to, start off as vandalism and, that being my canvas. And what a better place to, develop. It's almost like the boot camp of art school.
How did that happen for you, though?
I was already getting offered money for what I did, and I didn't really care about it because I had money. I hustled. I don't want to get too specific, but I hustled. I dabbled in the hustling world, the criminal life, so I was... not really interested in selling it, but it kind of crossed my mind that maybe this is something I should start figuring out how I can make money off of this. So when I can leave this other criminal life, I can go into this art world, And I've learned that would be harder than I thought too, because you can't just walk into galleries looking the way I do and talking the way I talk. But I think something about the mystique of me being a graffiti writer and it coming around to be something that people pump money and corporate pumps money into now. I had just once again in my life, I was like the Forrest Gump of this. I just always the right place, the right time, transitioning at the right time. So it was just a natural progression just to start selling it as, art. And,
so now, instead of writing on trains, you're writing on canvases.
Yes.
Right? And you're still doing essentially...
And large walls and murals.
But essentially still doing graffiti.
Yes. Yeah. I kind of switched it up, My style isn't just the normal... What I would paint illegally to what I would paint on canvases, I paint a lot more. It's not so ego-driven with just being my name. It's more about portraying a positive message or some sort of message or trying to get across something that I'm feeling at the time or just what, or something that I feel like people can, words they can live by, my own Bible
verses. What's an example of trying to get a positive message across in one of your pieces?
I try to tell people to park friendly and to be friendly and, just some good life lesson stuff, almost like great toast are made, just giving people almost like a blessing almost.
If I were to walk into a gallery and see one of your canvases and really fell in love with it, what's a general price range that I would have to pay for your work these days?
Man, the galleries, those guys go high. If you go to Mason Fine Art, talk to Mark, who's the owner of it, probably about $8,000.
Okay.
On the low end.
So you're doing well.
Sometimes, it's a roller coaster ride. Yeah. If I'm hanging out with Mark, I'm doing good. But, when I'm out here on my own.
It's funny you mentioned Mark because Mark actually did a show and he assembled 9 of you, as I recall.
Yeah.
I think, didn't he actually go to Home Depot or something and buy fake brick walls?
Yeah.
For some...
Man, I had to give it to that guy. The stuff that he's doing is pretty bold, especially in the South. That's not something that anybody's taken on. Galleries, they love us. I talk to gallery owners. They think I'm great, but they don't want to necessarily, have my art in their gallery. But they'll come up to me and give me my respect. But Mark came to us, and he bought, like you said, the fake brick walls, and he called the show Inside Out. He wanted to, really bring raw street graffiti. he's really opened a lot of minds. A lot of people who would probably still to this day frown on graffiti and anything that portrays it. But he really, you know, he's definitely stamped our passport in that world, a couple right. of us.
You alluded to, and I assume you don't much want to talk about your criminal past, because
right.
you do have one.
Pretty I don't mind talking about it.
Well, I mean, you were a drug dealer at one point, right?
You could say something like that, yeah?
Yeah.
I guess so.
I read, in fact, somewhere that you, I did read an interview where you sort of railed against the way in which big corporate cartels were taking over the sweet little mom and pop drug pushers in the neighborhood, and I thought that was pretty
strange. I think that just comes along with this town becoming a real city. You know, it was only a matter of time before they wouldn't let us do it ourselves.
Yeah, but you don't want to talk about. But it's you understand it's hard for an audience listening
yeah.
to you to think about your being critical of the big drug operation stomping on the little mom and pop drug dealer.
I guess because I was directly affected by it.
But here's why.
That's probably the same as the guy who used to own Ace Hardware or whatever who goes to Home Depot.
But here's the reason I even bring it up at all. You talked about God put you in the right place.
Yes.
And you'd have gone through some really difficult times. You have found yourself in a different place at your age, 30-something.
39 years old.
And you're now working as a commercial artist. You've changed.
Thank God.
That's my question. How big a role does God play in your life?
Man, I mean, I wouldn't consider myself religious. I don't go to church. My parents never pumped any sort of stuff into my head. But I think, you know, getting out of trouble so many times, big trouble, and also being in situations where I could have died or, you know, had to talk myself out of dying or whatever. I just started believing there must be a higher power. So I realized that anything I want, I can just sit there and just think about it all the time and I can bring it into my life
and
make it happen. And it's exciting every time. It's like magic.
Is the magic that a Felicia Feaster sees in your graffiti inspired by a higher power?
Yeah, I guess it is because you know, I've always tried to exude positive and, like, powerful things. And, you know, as my manager, Sarah, or my intern here, Bradley, can tell you, I have a negative overtone. I can have a short temper. But, you know, I try to trying to grow out of that, always growing further and further away from that and trying to exude, you know, electrical, bright colors and just, you know, trying to have some sort of, like, powerful, positive impact over the world, you know. And even if I can't let it affect myself, I try to make everybody else smile, even when I can't.
Well, Dax, I have to tell you, you've made me smile a lot.
Oh, you made me smile today.
In this conversation. And I'm really grateful to you for coming in and talking to me on Two-Way Street. I want to look for your trains now. Are there a lot of them out there?
I'd like to think there still are. You know, I did them right. I respected the load limits and the numbers and stuff. So my stuff usually runs a little longer than other people's, but you know, some of it might have just fallen off the train by now. But yeah, they still get caught. I see people putting them up on Instagram, and the kids can be kind of geeked up since I've retired from that, and to see that I still have all this stuff that I've left the world. I could die today.
Dax, thank you so much.
Thank you. Now you know, and I know, I done bumped every hole in the wall, y'all. Did you catch that phone call? Most of y'all done met me, thought I was tall. Yeah, flip like a deal, slip, fell on the black ice. Did you think twice? Home slice came and he went satisfied. Got bent balls, ain't immune coast to coast. Yeah, I left the boat, man, those too many. I've been talking with Dax Redneck, Dr. Dax. When he was young, Dax loved to write graffiti on walls, bridges, underpasses, and freight trains all over Atlanta. Like many of his friends, he thought of his work as vandalism. But now, he's an established artist whose graffiti canvases fetch upward of five figures apiece. If you'd like to see some of Dax's work, we've posted photos on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. And we have pictures of some of his work on our Facebook page, too. We're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we'll talk with High Museum curator Michael Rooks about Basquiat, the legendary New York street artist of the 1980s who became the brightest star of the neo-expressionist movement. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut.
We're talking today about artists who began as outlaws, painting graffiti and creating street art on public spaces all over urban areas and graduating to fine art galleries. Jean-Michel Basquiat was arguably the most important of the American street artists. He started as a vandal, but became a celebrated artist and a star of the New York City cultural scene. Now the High Museum of Art has mounted an exhibition called Basquiat, The Unknown Notebooks. It's a rare display of the notebooks the artist used to work out his ideas. We talked about the show with Michael Rooks, the highest curator of modern and contemporary art, and I started by asking him about the evolution of Basquiat's work.
Yeah, so in Lower Manhattan, he's living on the streets and begins making graffiti with his friend Al Diaz. He went to school, high school with Al Diaz, and they formed this collective, this duo, and they called their duo Samo, with a copyright symbol after the Samo, which was a critique of commercialism, of materialism. And Samo stands for same old shit, essentially. What they did was they wrote these aphorisms and these disjunctive poetry on the streets of Lower Manhattan, and that got the attention of the art world at the time, which was relatively small. It was very mysterious. People were wondering, who is this savant, this poet who is living on the street, this shadowy guy who goes by the name Samo? Because it wasn't like graffiti. It wasn't like tagging and defacing property and tagging billboards, etc. It was producing poetry. Really, we call him in the exhibition a graffiti poet at this stage in his life.
What were some of the images that he was putting up on the wall?
The imagery usually was a face, a kind of a face, a stylized face that he would draw and redraw through the course of his career. And you'll see a number of those faces in the exhibition, in the sketchbook pages, but also in larger drawings and in one painting that we have. It's actually not a painting, it's a piece of graffiti. It's a piece of drywall that's cut out of an apartment and framed. So you actually get to see real graffiti art. There is a whole iconography that he developed on the street. You see teepees, little automobiles that are deceptively childlike in how they're drawn, and other kinds of images that are they're essential to his language, because they get at this larger critique of institutional racism, of inequality, of his solidarity, for example, with Native Americans. The teepee recurs often. You'll see that in this exhibition as well. So it's part of a larger program that evolves in his career when he transitions from the street to the gallery.
In the early days of his work, there were a lot of people doing graffiti art in New York. It was a time when that became a very rich field for artistic expression, right?
Absolutely, yeah, right, absolutely. Many, many artists came out of that milieu. It really was the invention of a new art form. Basquiat took it in a different direction using language, and language became central in his work. Basquiat was very minimal, very, very powerful in the succinct use of language.
One of the things you point out is that words play a powerful role in a lot of the work that he did.
Right. One of his great innovations was to combine, to synthesize this language of the street with the new form of, or rather style of painting, which was neo-expressionism.
He at one point said this. He said, "There are about 30 words around you all the time, like thread or exit." And then he says he uses words like brushstrokes. That's an interesting image in and of itself, words like brushstrokes.
They're imagistic, so it's like concrete poetry, essentially. His ability to conjure imagery through text or simply a word.
Let's listen to how he describes some of that.
Where do the words come from? Real-life books? Television.
Yeah, and you just skim them and start including.
No, I mean, when I'm working, I hear them, you know, and I just throw them down.
Oh, yeah? Well, I mean, things like Punic Wars. I remember that was in one of your.
Oh, that was from a guidebook on Roman history.
And you had been reading it, and.
Well, it wasn't that long, that actual history part of it. It's like, you know, history of Roman, five pages, you know?
Yeah. and so you snatched a few words from it.
Yeah, I didn't snatch them, you know.
They caught your...
They caught my eye, and I took them.
So that's Basquiat giving an interview to an art writer who, throughout that whole conversation, really struggles to communicate with him.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear also the kind of glibness that he, with which he answers these kinds of questions. Clearly, he does skim over a great broad range of materials in his life and in his career, and brings many of these sources and interests to bear in his work.
It seems to me that there is an irony about the trajectory of his career, in the sense that he came to people's attention as Samo, and as you point out, with the copyright at the end. At that point, to mock, in many ways, corporate America. And I think the institutionalization of the art world as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as his career took off, as he became an enormous success, he himself became a part of that, whether he wanted to be or not. He became, to some extent, captive of that very art world, didn't he?
Yeah. It seems he became consumed by it, the very institutions that he was critiquing in this very rapid trajectory. And, you know, at the same time, would, in the work itself, continue to maintain the integrity of his vision and the integrity of that voice, that critical voice that was addressing inequities, the subjects that really occupied the entirety of his career. Basquiat represented a phenomenon that was really new to everybody in this rise, this meteoric rise, instant fame. It's what the art world still is charmed by, this idea of instant fame connected with youth, a radical kind of transgressive vision, you know, or originality. The thing about Basquiat is, it's true, he was incredibly innovative. He was, what he did was so original that I think it was hard to wrap your head around it at the time. And so instead, I think he was framed as this darling. I really do not like the use of that word when it comes to him, but it's used all the time, right?
Yeah.
Art world darling.
Yes.
Well, that's how he was framed by the media, and that's how he was treated by a lot of the people he surrounded himself with toward the end of his life. And that did not serve him well. And I think precipitated his overdose.
So let's talk about what we'll all see when we come to the Haim Museum in the exhibition that you have up now.
There's 8 notebooks that we have on view. 7 of them have been sort of disassembled so that you can see every page of the notebook, including the cover. One notebook is still in its entirety in a vitrine. So it's really interesting to see how... the words, the sort of word collage that he designs on each sheet of paper are extruded into the larger works, whether they're drawings or paintings. But at the same time, they are artworks in and of themselves, which is why they've been disassembled. Each page has been removed from the notebooks to demonstrate the importance of design. One page has, I think, 5 words. Love is a lie, and the next line down, love equals liar, which is really interesting in its sort of poetry, but also the very personal nature of that sentiment, and it's centered on the page. That's was striking to me when I first saw it. In addition to that, we've got dozens of drawings and paintings and some objects that he made. In addition to, there's an excerpt of a film called Downtown 81 that he was featured in. He was starred in this film. It was a narrative film, a fictional film, but he essentially played himself. He was a self-made rock star. He made it himself from the streets, from someone who was asking for handouts to buy, you know, junk food, to someone who was making millions of dollars and didn't know what to do with it. As a self-made DIY artist, he was an inspiration to artists, hip-hop artists in this city and across the country, and to other artists who worked in the street as a milieu for developing ideas and for declaring oneself and declaring the relevancy of one's life in a world that seems that sometimes is uncaring and cold. And so his example is a tremendous inspiration still to so many artists and so many musicians or writers or visual artists, poets.
Michael Rooks is the curator of modern and contemporary art at the High Museum of Art. We talked to him about the current exhibition, Basquiat, The Unknown Notebooks. The show will run until the end of May. We're just about out of time for today's show, but as usual, the Two-Way Street website will have lots of added content about Dr. Dax, our first guest, and the Basquiat exhibition at the High. You can also see that same material on the Two-Way Street Facebook page. Our producer is Jenny Amon. I'm Bill Nigut. Thanks for listening, and I hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.
Many a day has passed, the night has gone by, but still I find the time to put that bomb off in your eye. Total chaos, but these playoffs thought we was absent. We're taking another route to represent the Dungeon family like Grey Day. Me and my decide to take the back way. We stabbing every city, then we headed to that back cave. ATL, Georgia, what do we do? Fall ya, bulldogging like them Georgetown Hawkers. Boy, you signed the silly thing, my room is sitting pretty, doing donuts. Why you suckers like them suckers around titties? Damn, we the committee.